This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
I'm Heather Brown, and this is the Between the Covers podcast. Time for another episode of The Stone Carvers, Jane Urquhart's sweeping saga of war, remembrance, and art. The book follows the stories of several characters through different times and events in their lives. Clara Becker is our main character, and her life unfolds in scenes from her childhood, her first steps into love, and her struggles as a spinster. Along the way, we witness Father Justier's arrival in Ontario from Bavaria in the mid-1800s and his efforts to gather a parish around his newly built church. In today's episode, Father Justier is about to see a dream made real, and Clara's life is wrenched in a different direction.
In June of 1869, when the second Corpus Christi procession had completed its one-mile tour of the church grounds, Father Archangel Justier rose from the long makeshift table where he had been enjoying the baked goods of his female parishioners and gazed around the cleared acreage. He began to place on the table, one after another, the 20 iron railway spikes that had been brought to him the previous day by a tinker who worked the roads of the surrounding territory. "These," Father Justier announced to the assembled, "are the beginnings of our great stone church." That spring, enough field stones had surfaced under the plows of the farmers to make an adequate start at the foundation. The bishop was summoned, the cornerstone was laid and blessed, and oxen, horses, and a team of 30 volunteers provided the labor. In early August of that year, dozens of healthy young men, men who in Europe would have made fine soldiers, gathered at the site of the church and ascended a multitude of ladders. Under the shelter of the soaring, timbered, and slated roof, by the light shining through newly installed window glass, they began, quite carefully, to dismantle the small structure that had until that very moment served as the community's place of worship. Then they took that structure, log by log, out the front door of the new stone church, leaving the planked floor, the pine pews, and an altar carved by Joseph Becker, surrounded by a margin of bright green indoor grass. Father Justier, who presided over the project, was most moved by this last act of labor. It seemed to him as if he were watching time itself being carried in the arms of youth, and as if the pile of logs being assembled in the moonlight was a kind of monument that both celebrated and mourned the receding past. A few weeks after the news of the war reached Chauneval, Eamon told Clara that he felt compelled to go. "Who knows," he added, "if I go they might let me fly an aeroplane. They will be crucial from now on in any war. Then when I come back I'll keep one in the barn." Clara's response was one of sudden, cold fear. How could he step away from her now? Place an ocean between them, put himself and their love at risk, and all for the love of an airborne toy. Eamon's Irish father had told him that no son of his was going off to fight for England, and that if he chose to do so, he would be a son of his no more. When Eamon reported this in an outraged voice, certain of the injustice, courting her sympathy, she crossed the kitchen and slapped his face with such violence that tears sprang into his eyes. "You're a fool, Eamon O'Sullivan," she hissed. "A fool and an infant. I want nothing more to do with you." She watched as the shape her blow had made appeared on his shocked face, the way the anger entered his expression. After the screen door banged behind him, Clara went out to her workshop, bolted the door, and worked on the abbess for the remainder of the afternoon, sharpening her tools to make the woman's features and the folds of her garments angular and determined. When she finally emerged into moonlight and August heat, even the trees and buildings seemed to shrink under the angry grief of her gaze. As she climbed the stairs to her room, she felt the temperature rise. Clara undressed, fell face down on the bed, and remembered with sorrow that just a week before, Eamon's sleeping face had rested in the hollow of the same hand that had just struck him. and yet when she was awakened an hour later by the sound of a carefully lifted window, the sense that she had been betrayed by him returned, and she quickly covered herself with a sheet and told him to leave. "For God's sake, Clara!" There was fear now on his always readable face. He held out his arms to her. "Don't," she whispered, her knees drawn up, her face hidden on the sheet that was covering her arms and shoulders. "We'll get married," he said, "before I leave." He had thought it was that. She looked up at him, astonished. After this mutiny, the certainty of chosen absence, marriage seemed impossible to her. How could he not know that? She should never have trusted her own passion, this animal that paced around the edges of her character. She was right to have been wary in the beginning, suspicious of the sound of its first unrecognized footstep. Reaching for a box on the table by her bedside, she opened it and pulled tight the amber necklace she kept there, snapping the string, beads spilling across the sheets and bouncing on the floor. Eamon had given her this gift. "I don't want it anymore," she said quietly. The bruised, wounded look that came over his face would be recorded by Clara's mind and would be carried there for years to come. The string of bright beads, he had told her, would remind her of the 20 brightest days they had spent together, and a promise of 20 more, and then 20 more, infinitely. When she broke the beads, she had been throwing all the bright days away. But now, as Clara shifted and one final amber bead clattered on the wood floor, Eamon stood before her, his face flushed, his shoulders hunched, as if cringing in the wake of a physical attack. Then he had straightened and stood briefly, powerfully above her in the room. "I can only hope," he said as he moved toward the window, "that you'll love me better when I get back." On a clear weekday in October of 1885, Father Archangel Gestir, who by now was reaching the age of retirement, sat on the front steps of his church, admiring the staggering display of autumn color that poured through the air from nearby maples and carpeted the hills that surrounded the village. When an approaching wagon caught his attention, he noticed that it carried a crate so large it could have held a milk house, one of Joseph Becker's altars, a small chapel, or for that matter, another wagon. For the first time since the church's consecration several years before, the good father experienced the thrill of anticipation. Four men drove toward him. Two sat on the vehicle's front seat, and the others leaned their backs against the blonde wood of the box. They stood on arrival, and after lifting several long boards stacked beside the crate, they made a ramp to slide their burden to the ground. "What is it?" he asked. "Is it for me?" "It's a heavy son of a bitch, whatever it is," a red-faced man replied. Then he remembered where he was. "Sorry, Father." After the crate was torn apart by crowbars and a prodigious amount of straw was thrown to the winds, a beautiful bell was revealed, its bronze surface glowing in a muted manner like the tanned and stretched hide of a great animal. It was as tall as the men who had unpacked it, and were now running their hands over its surface and exclaiming with surprise. When the priest composed himself and raised his face, it was not toward the bell that he directed his gaze, not toward the men who stood in embarrassed silence at the foot of the steps. Instead, he rose to his feet, turned his back on the bell, and looked up toward the empty belfry through which a sudden autumn wind was blowing a flock of multicolored leaves. And after that, the world abruptly returned, and Father Gestir understood that the details of how to manage his heart's desire were going to have to be considered. Arrangements were going to have to be made. The bishop would eventually have to be summoned to bless the bell. Some sort of winch would have to be constructed to hoist it up to its rightful place in the tower. The very fact of the bell's presence, the very fact of its solid existence, suddenly exhausted the aging priest. The next morning, when a crowd of excited villagers climbed the hill, they were surprised to find their spiritual leader neither in the vicinity of the bell nor inside his church. "And so I was elected to look for him in the rectory," Joseph Becker would tell his granddaughter decades later. "And there he was," the old man would continue sadly, his eyes wide open, but with no life in them. A stroke? A heart attack? Who could say, there being no medical experts in the vicinity? On the bedside table was a scrap of paper on which was written in a shaky hand, "I committed the sin of covetousness. Pray for me." The bell. Joseph crumpled the note in his fist and stuffed it in his pocket, told no one about it. "But I did pray for him," he said to Clara much later. Clara felt that if she did not speak of Eamon's departure, and if she made it known to her father and her grandfather that she would not tolerate inquiries, she would soon recover from the overwhelming feelings of loss that attacked her late at night and early in the morning, as she lay under the covers of the bed in which, until Eamon had come into her life, she had always slept alone. She threw away everything connected to the boy, the studio photograph he had given her, the amber beads she had swept from every corner of her room, the pearl promise ring she knew was all he could afford. What she wanted now was never again to be torn from sleep by love, never again to be awakened by grief. When Clara heard the rumor at Sunday Mass that Eamon was missing, she was at first unsurprised. "Of course he's missing," she thought. "He's been gone. I haven't seen him for more than 2 years." The rumor would fade. She would never have to hear it again. That Monday morning, after he'd heard the news about Eamon from the proprietor of the hardware store, Joseph Becker returned to the house and paced the kitchen for almost half an hour, his son's pleading eyes on him. The war had now gone on long enough that both men knew that those reported missing were not likely to be heard from again. Young men who had lost limbs and could therefore not be reintegrated into the fray had returned to their hometowns of Goderich and Listowel with reports of battles so deadly that afterwards there had been no hope of identifying their lost companions. Neither man could bear to tell Clara, but eventually Joseph volunteered and stepped slowly out of the house toward her workshop. Clara had not said the boy's name aloud for more than 2 years, and she did not say it now. But when she saw her grandfather, grim of face, walking without his coat across the snowy yard, she knew suddenly that her hand would never again touch Eamon's warm cheek, that she had lost him forever. When the old man opened the door and said, "Eamon," she would not permit him to finish the sentence. "Stop," she whispered, her mouth losing color, the chisel she held dropping to the floor. "Clara," he tried again, but she was past him in a moment and out the door. In the house, she ran up the stairs to the sunroom, where she searched furiously for any frail bits of Eamon that she might not have discarded, measurements, that one photograph, all that she had thrown away. And then she remembered, crossed the room and stood for some time staring at the engraved shape of the pattern she had drawn, all that was left of him now. And she recalled what her grandfather had told her about the likeness of medieval knights in full armor being drawn with a chisel on their marble burial slabs. He would have only the traces of a waistcoat as a memorial. She folded to the floor, her hand near the spot where his heart might have been. Everything in her wanted her innocence back, knowing her girlhood had gone to the grave with a young man who had bewitched her with a combination of silence and song, that and the shock of his touch. The details of the last time she had seen him ran over and over in her mind. She attempted to reconstruct the scene, change the outcome, to melt, in retrospect, her own coldness. She listened to the slow beat of the pendulum clock, the stupid progression of time. The next morning, when the men walked into the kitchen for breakfast, they found Clara dry-eyed and bleak, with only one warning sentence on her lips. I'll not speak of this again.
Nikki Guadagni reading Episode 7 of Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart. In the next episode, we find out what happened to Tilman, Clara's younger brother. The novel is published by Viking Press. You can subscribe to this podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.